could see there's been an evolution in terms of the additions, the shadowing, the messaging around what that understanding behaviour component looks like. I mean, underpinned by that central component of the conflict spiral and stages of a crisis model, they're key underpinnings. So, but sitting alongside of that, from that behaviour, the PBS lens, the incorporation of a PBS best practice, and there is a PBS best practice site in the US that names the competing behaviour model as one of the seven practices, highly evidence-based supporting practices around that. So in essence, the model sits there as an additional component on how we can start to decode behaviour and just give that additional lens. So starting with a problem behaviour, and I know around the room many of you have either seen this, been aware of it, or have had some degree of engagement with it, but let's just do a quick check. Competing behaviour model, how many people will be familiar with, because we've got some doyens in the room in terms of PBS and that area. How many are familiar, have heard of it, but not into the intricacies of it? How many have not heard of the competing behaviour model or competing behaviour framework? Okay, so I'll go back with some base level information. The work, in essence, is the work of Sagai and Horner, going way back into the 90s, 2000s. The model itself is built around this particular process, or this particular framework. Begins with... It begins with the definition of what the problem behaviour is. So now we're talking practitioner in the classroom. There's an unfolding problem within the classroom. Begin with what that problem behaviour looks like and defining what it is as an observable sense. So what does it look like? And so from there, then...
This is where we've adapted it slightly.
It used to say maintaining consequence.
Yeah.
So, if we have this square here, in the model as it stood before, it used to be called the maintaining consequence, and the logic behind that, as Sugai would describe, would be what's the maintaining consequence that makes this problem behaviour useful in that context? In other words, how is this useful as a life tool, and what is it maintaining for that young person at that point? Or as we phrased it here, the what's in it for me. So that what's in it for me becomes that, in essence, the driver. Now we know, and I'm going to put that what's in it for me.
So just to pause, like the rationale, and you don't have to do this, you can change it back to maintaining consequences, but in schools, when you talk about consequences, what do everyone think of?
It's a punitive thing.
What happens to them? Yeah, so I think you're just not going to confuse people, because they're thinking about what's the consequence on the kid, not why did they do what they did.
And there's a significant lens change, because if we talk about what's in it for me in regards to the student, that's internal locus within the student, why is that behaviour useful? If we talk about externalised, what's the consequence that applies to that? We're talking about a different agent side. Okay, well, how am I going to change that behaviour as a function from the side? In essence, then going to, okay, well, what is the function of that behaviour? Now, we know function, we're talking about gain or avoid. Really, what we're talking about, what's the reasonable hypothesis that we can develop underneath that, that problem behaviour might have a gain or avoid function. The what's in it for me, in essence, the distilled hypothesis, what's going on, and then, of course, function sitting here. Then from there, the rest of the chain, it's that identification of the antecedent, and then from there, the identification of the setting event. So that functional element, or that sense of real base level assessment, because if we're talking about a very base level functional behaviour assessment, we're talking about identifying behaviour, having some sense of exploration of what's in it for me, a hypothesised function in that regard, let's just call those two, then figuring out, okay, can we identify what that antecedent was, now where's the setting event? And a common example, I'm just going to call of a common example I use a lot with the grads, because it's easy to come up with that common example because it's sitting right here. It's 11 o'clock on a Friday, there's a spelling test. There's a child that doesn't wish to do the spelling test. They rip the work up, they begin that demonstrative challenging behaviour at that point, indicate very strongly with their behaviour they're not going to do the test. And some of that then behaviour starts to very much look like challenging. The what's in it for me, clearly that one that result could be looked at as an avoid. I wish to avoid the test. But what's in it for me in terms of the hypothesis, there was a very interesting function that I'll get to, or the what's in it for me in a moment, and unpack that a little bit further. But suffice to say, this one is about avoid, and I'm avoiding the spelling test. Well, he was avoiding the spelling test. The antecedent was the spelling test. It was a consistent and reliable antecedent, because in the 3 weeks that we were doing the observations, the 3 weeks that served as the antecedent, reliably and predictably. So reliably and predictably, we identified an event that led to a particular behaviour set. We were then clearly hypothesising about what happened. Now, that hypothesising was about talking to the teacher, and it was about talking to other stakeholders. Interestingly, we integrated the kid into that conversation, and this is what we found out, how life intersected with behaviour and using behaviour to achieve a function. In a previous set of weeks, there had been the antecedent of the spelling test. The child had done the test, however, performed poorly. The results were called out. Out in the playground, a student called that kid a retard. On being called a retard, he experienced a strong sense of shame. So if I go back to conflict spiral, there was an experience that led to some incredibly strong feelings. The behaviour in the following weeks was about, I'm going to use this behaviour because there's a strong what's in it for me based on this notion of shame. I'm not going to do this test. I'm not going to have a low result called out to everyone else and have my kids in the class demean me in that way. So that behaviour became incredibly functional. So in discussion with the teacher, we noted that that behaviour sat there, there were strong feelings that were driving that, and clearly there was a function there. What do we do? So in terms of the model, now it looks like, what's the response strategies? What are we seeking to do? And the competing behaviour model, it's about not, it is about impacting on this behaviour, but coming up with a behaviour that competes with it, so that that behaviour no longer has utility, because we have another behaviour down here that, given that antecedent, meets this what's in it for me and function. Now, clearly, we identified that avoid was a major thing here. We identified there were strong feelings that were driving that. Acknowledging that feeling and function at that point, how can we come up with a behaviour that's more utilitarian than that and causes less impact? We gave him options to avoid. We legitimised what options for avoiding look like. We said, clearly, you can do the test if you wish. We are not preventing you from doing the test. Do the test to your heart's content. Second option, would you like to read? He was a great lover of R.L. Stein's series. I can't even remember what they were called now. That's it, yeah, great question. So the notion of, would you like to, was a favourite option. We also gave him another default option, because following that stimulus, he was very creative, he liked to draw. But then, yeah, you can draw to your heart's content as well. So we were seemingly, from that particular model's perspective, or this model's perspective, trying to come up with a set of behaviours that could meet that function and compete with that and shrink it. And shrink it we did. After a couple of weeks, what happened, there was engagement. So there was engagement with these options here, with the agency of the kid, with the discussions with, understanding what that was about and what those pathways were, so that that behaviour became less important. The risk prior to that is that behaviour, that problem behaviour, started to look like a habit that was being formed, and it was starting to be externalised and used for a range of other functions. In other words, geez, that gets me out of a spelling test. How would it be on another event in the class that I'd like to avoid? How might I do this? And it became somewhat of higher utility. We did need to compete with it. So that competition over here to come up with that option worked well. Now, clearly, there was a degree of resistance from the teacher, because it moved out of the channels of entrenched thought that they were on. What would be some of the challenges that a teacher may come up with in regards to that? Are we ever going to let them do a test again? Yeah. Are they going to get out of everything from now on? What will the other kids say?
It's always how you want to
see it. Now those...
They get to do that.
Yeah. How about another kid that wants to do it? Do I have all of the kids behaving in this way to meet this test? Well, interestingly though, all of the kids in the class didn't have that feeling in a result to that antecedent. Would they direct copy? Would they really have that strong what's in it for me? So we move beyond that, because part of that challenge of this model is you're actually flying in the face of accepted orthodoxy in classrooms and adult theory about how things work. Everyone else will copy. You know, are we ever going to, you know, there's a range of boulders that sit in the way of progress. But anyway, the basis of the model that Sugai describes here is, as I say, complete with that. When that has then been weakened and it's been lessened, in other words, the heat has been moved as such, the option of then introducing what we consider to be the desired behaviour, or let's call it a target behaviour. But the great beauty of the particular model is it's not about going, okay, can we have a target behaviour to avoid that function? It's actually about the creation of a new function. And is there a new function that can be built around gain, which is informed by feelings other than shame, but feelings of success? And that great driver that fits most primary kids is, I want to be like everyone else. I want to fit in. I want to be accepted. I want to have a view of myself as a successful learner. So then the pathway is about how can we have a set of, or how can we design a set of conditions for behaviour that help to create a new function. And looking at that model, well, it's called the competing behaviour model, and yeah, it does compete with that behaviour. The interesting thing is it shifts function. Now, we know that. When we look at it, we go, yeah, that actually makes sense. And it's actually the element of good practice and teachers everywhere do it. All it is naming the process and becoming quite strategic about what those steps look like. So that actually is the competing behaviour model. And the use of it within, as I say, I go to a very here, it's the whole truckload, and here it all is. But to other groups, it's unpacked to the measure of which is useful for them. So that sits within
right.
there.
Any additions, questions?
Well, I'm assuming they stopped making the spelling test results public.
Yeah, that's sort of the first thing
yes.
I thought.
Now, here is the key point, because a lot of this here, a lot of that is generated by an antecedent that is like, oh, this is just what we're going to do in an unthinking way that leads to those moments in the playground of, but you're a retard, you never succeed. So a lot of it is actually about rethinking about what we're doing. So, but rethinking what we're doing, sometimes I find that, well, I think it's a bit of an uncommon reality sometimes. And just as the basis of how, you know, Sugai explains this model, it's about going, well, if that's the behaviour, acknowledge it, compete with it, weaken it, take the heat out of it, teach a target. And in essence, I think the great beauty of it is you're moving function. That's the change that starts to occur. So yeah, the behaviour changes, but the behaviour is just incidental. It's really about what's that movement of function. And this is just not me speaking. This is the article. This is the PBS Best Practices Bulletin paper. This is conversations with Sugai way back when, or just engaging in other areas with that and looking at that model in depth. So it's not the philosophy of life. It's very much informed by what those practices are. And